Hello and welcome to another episode of Extraordinary Brains. I'm Max Davey. No test today. It's our last Parton special. Tessa will be back next episode, whenever that might be. We don't exactly know. She's in the middle of GCSE revision, but it will be a duo next time, we promise. The dog is here, but he is not necessarily an audio pleasure. Very much a visual pleasure, Gizmo, that's right. So today is another chat with Natasha Hickling. Natasha is a brilliant ADHD coach who also has ADHD. She's on Indigo Hub, anywhere on the internet, and I think is just a tremendous person. We talk to her, we talk to Ben, her husband, and we have the answer to a couple of questions from her mum, which is a great pleasure. So it's probably the kind of most comprehensive look at somebody with neurodiversity from the outside that we have. So I really enjoyed it. I always enjoyed chatting with Natasha, and it was very nice to meet Ben. Away we go. So hello, welcome Ben and Natasha to Extraordinary Brains. Natasha, you have obviously been on episode insert number when I remember which one it is here. It will be about 10, I think. And you are an ADHD coach, recently moved back from Malaysia to the UK. And Ben, so what we've said about the partners is you are here primarily as Natasha's partner. But if there's anything else that you think the audience should know about you, other than the fact that you are, you know, her other half, as it were.
I don't know, really.
So you're still in Malaysia. What are you doing out there?
Yeah, I'm still in Malaysia. I guess I think when Tasha recorded with you, she was here.
Yep, she was.
Basically her contract expired and mine didn't, is the short version. And her coaching business was taken off. There was a lot of clients coming from the UK. So
yeah.
You know, there were plans in place to keep her here, but it kind of fell through. So we just decided to pull the trigger and send Tash home. And then I could have left with Tasha, but I wasn't prepared to leave halfway through an academic year.
Yes.
I'm a teacher as well.
Right.
And I've got students taking exams, you know, in a couple of months' time. That I've had for their whole sort of exam course.
Gosh, yeah.
So I wasn't really prepared to just leave sort of.
Yeah, I can understand that completely. Notice.
So the compromise was, yes, I'll come home with you, but it will be at the end of the academic year. Rather than immediately.
So what do you teach?
Mathematics, maths.
Excellent subject.
Yeah.
All right. You can use maths for everything, can't you?
Yeah.
It seeps into all sorts of corners and crevices.
Yeah.
So the first question we were asking all of the partners is, what is it that you noticed first about Natasha?
In what sense?
Well, in any sense of the word.
like when we first met, you mean?
Yeah.
I don't know, really. She was very chatty. I'm not particularly chatty, so it works quite well.
Yeah.
If there's ever a silence, it's filled by Tasha. Filled. So that works quite well for me.
Yeah, that's good. So you've noticed the chattiness. And were there anything about her that sort of marked her out? You thought she's a bit different to other people, or, you know, just sort of made her stand out?
I don't know, really. She was very passionate. When we met, she had just finished her like teacher training year of university, and I was just starting mine. And she was very passionate about teaching and very kind of, you know, I don't know what the word is, like going for it.
Go-getting.
Yeah. And I like that. I like that she was kind of ambitious and wanted to do a really good job and stuff like that.
Fantastic. And at what point in Natasha's journey towards understanding her ADHD, when did you become aware of it, and how did that feel for you? Was that a big impact on you? Were you like, whatever?
Well, I mean, I guess the ADHD part of Tasha's neurodiversity, if you like, we kind of experienced together. So obviously she's got like dyslexia and dyspraxia, yes, and things like that. But she knew all of that like when I met. But we learnt about the ADHD stuff whilst we were already together. So it was we kind of did the whole thing together. But by that point, how's the way to say it? Like, we already kind of, we'd been together probably, 5 or 6 years at that point. Mm. So we were already kind of had systems and stuff in place without really knowing that ADHD, yeah, was what we were sort of coping with, if that makes sense. Mm. So it didn't really affect me in terms of everyday life, because it was just the Tasha that I knew, and we finally had a sort of name for it, if you like.
Yes.
I mean, there are a few systems that we've had to put in place since learning about the ADHD that Tasha's kind of honed in on, which I occasionally forget about and get snapped at if I don't do this and that. But no, it's you know, it's the way that she is, and it's what she needs to help her cope. You know, I've said this to her, like she experiences difficulties that I can't even comprehend. So if there's things that I can do that make it easier for her, then, you know, it's no skin off my nose, is it? If you know, I have to do this and that I wouldn't normally do to help out.
As long as you remember to do it, of course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's not got a good memory. I'm jumping in there. His memory is not the greatest. So we have to write lists and stuff.
And if you think about it now, what are the things that you find challenging about the dyspraxia, the dyslexia, the ADHD? What are the things that challenge you at this point now?
Not really sure. I guess now that we sort of know about it, and there's sort of names for things and stuff like that, it's like when I forget, it's like I feel bad, and it's like, you know, I'm trying to help, and sometimes I don't say the right thing, or, you know, this and that, and it, you know, we argue because something is taken in the wrong way or something like that, and it's like, no, I didn't mean to say it, you know, like that.
So a lot of that is pretty typical coupled stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think so.
It's sort of filtered through this lens sometimes, yeah, of the neurodiversity.
I guess so. Yeah,
say that's fair.
Yeah. Yeah,
Natasha, you joining us as well? Whereas the previous episodes of this series, the partner's not been around. What do you think that's something that you recognise as well?
Yeah, like emotional regulation has always been quite a big part of my ADHD, and like in that RSD, like having the rejection. So like sometimes Ben will say things that I interpret it in my head, and then before I can say, oh, you didn't mean it like that, oh, you meant it like that, I just go at, yes, him. And then obviously
before you can say it to yourself.
Yeah. Before I can say it to myself, I hear like one word and then I'm like, what? You know, and then because I'm quite hyper, I have quite a lot of hyperactivity, my reactions or responses to him can be quite, yeah, you know, sometimes explosive. Not as much anymore. They used to be, but yeah, and I think it's that when you take something in and you take it on personally because of the life that I've had, and then the emotions then come out because of obviously that reaction to it.
Yeah, it might be worth explaining to the audience what RSD stands for and your understanding of what it is, because I think it's something that's talked about quite a lot in the ADHD group, in community. The words.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that's a really interesting concept that we're sort of still getting our heads around, I think, in the kind of professional world.
So RSD stands for rejection sensitivity dysphoria. And there's not that much science on it yet, but basically it can be part of two things, right? It can be part of, I was actually explaining this yesterday, it can be a part of the fact that the environmental of years and years living, you know, maybe not reaching your potential, not getting there, having to do things in a different way. So when people do say things to you, it can be taken quite literally and feel rejection because we've had so much of it, because because we've not been able to sit there in a class or do things, we always felt weird or not fitted in, so it can be like perceived as a rejection. And then after a while and years of telling yourself the same story, you believe it, right? And it becomes like the RSD becomes a belief, and then everyone that says things to you can become. But then also there's that hypersensitivity of people with ADHD, yes. So that we are more prone to the feelings and the emotions. So there's kind of that which heightens the experience of rejection. So it's kind of that hypersensitivity, but then there's also kind of that years and years of living kind of not, you know, thinking that you're weird when it's just that we think differently.
And that makes a lot of sense, actually, because I've read about it a few times, and that makes a huge amount of sense, because it's sort of a mixture of the kind of neurodevelopmental difference, the kind of biological difference in a way, and trauma is almost too strong a word, but it's like negative experiences, internalized negative experiences.
Yeah, like environmental,
that kind of colour, your instinctive responses to things. That makes a lot of sense. Well, that's great. That's a bit of learning for me. Lovely. Brilliant. Always nice. Every day is a learning day. Except, obviously, especially when you're a teacher. So let's go back to Ben. It's difficult, isn't it? Because you've got a partner who is just, I get the strong sense that you sort of, Natasha is Natasha, and, you know, that's the package. That's what you get. You know what I mean? But what are the things that you think, actually thinking about it, that difference, that diversity of brain really brings and gives you, and that you feel kind of thankful for in a way?
We complement each other quite well because we're quite opposite in a lot of things. So like, for example, I'll leave things, and Tasha must have them done now.
Oh, right.
So things like that, it helps me to kind of get up and go a lot, which I'm quite grateful for. Since she's moved back to the UK, like, for example, some screws fell out of one of the bar stools that I've got in the kitchen here, and it took me about 3 weeks to screw them back in because it was like, oh, well, I'll just sit on the other bar stool.
There's only one of you, so why do you need two?
If Tasha was still here, it would have been done same day. But like stuff like that. She's very, very creative and things like that. I'm amazed at the strategies and the things that she comes up with when she was teaching, like the lesson plans and stuff that she was just pulling out of thin air. Like she'd be talking about something and oh, I've got an idea for a lesson plan, and then we'd talk about something completely
there's always a kind of background, there's always background
really quite incredible to watch her work and what she comes up with. I'm fascinated by it.
Well, just watching this brain kind
without sounding like someone that's got binoculars from the other side of the road.
Well, you need more than binoculars because you're in Malaysia and she's in England. you need a satellite link when you do.
But like stuff like that and how passionate she is about, I mean, I don't know if that's part of the neurodiversity, if that's just part of Tasha or a mixture of both, but she's so passionate about things and, she really goes wholehearted into things. I guess that sometimes can be a bit of a double-edged sword, but she doesn't let it, you know, if there are setbacks and that, she doesn't let them get to her, you know, she goes again and stuff like that, yeah.
And that's a really interesting, much as also that's a really, those are lovely things to say, aren't they? And it's lovely. It's a really interesting question, isn't it? So I think I get the impression that there is something about neurodiverse people that makes us more passionate, single-minded about the things that we really care about. But Natasha, do you get that impression? But I also worry that that's just us telling ourselves how wonderful we are as a group. And maybe we just come across the people who are also really passionate and driven because that's how we brush against each other, because we're getting, you know, we're meeting through ADHD UK and, you know, kind of reaching out to people on social media and stuff. So, I mean, what do you think? Do you think there's something inherent to neurodiversity that makes you more passionate?
Yeah, I think especially with like the hyperactivity is the energy. Yeah. And like, so for instance, I sometimes would go to interviews and people would be like, oh, you're a bit gushy, like you just calm it down a bit. I'm like, what? Because like they'd ask a question, I'd be like, oh, right, I know the answer, and I start using my hands and stuff like that. And that's like when Ben did that. I really wish that was on camera, like when Ben was like doing that impression of like when I get ideas, and he even like moved his head.
I really wish
I got on camera, because that's exactly what I do. It's more to an extreme. Like, obviously people are passionate about it, but like I feel like when a lot of people with ADHD, because they have that energy, that passion, that spirit, it heightens the experience even more.
Yeah, that's true. I feel, specifically on ADHD, I think there's two different, the two main groups we think we talk about is ADHD and autism, although those don't exhaust all of the categories of neurodiversity, it's important to say. But I think in two different ways. I think for ADHD people, I've always felt that I have energy that needs to be funneled. If it doesn't get funneled, it festers. And some of it goes into work, but it can't all go into work because work drives me completely mental. So partly this is what this is about. This is a non-stressful way that my energy can be expended, because there's nothing stressful about running a podcast unless you actually care how many people listen, which I've decided not to. Spoilers.
Brilliant.
Although I want people to listen, but you know what I mean. I don't worry about the numbers. I do want them to go up, but I don't worry about it. So I suppose there's that. I think that's definitely my experience, and I think with autistic people, I think you've got to be really careful, haven't you? But I think there is a single-mindedness about the autistic brain, which is often thought of as coming from a limitation. Yes. And I don't think of it like that. Sometimes I think it does come from a kind of difficulty with change, difficulty with, you know, sort of learning new things. But actually often it comes from, and I think about Liz Francis, whose husband is one of the kind of interviewees in this series. Liz's comes from this really deep sense of justice, and that things needing to be fair or right. And I think a lot of it for, you know, when you go away from the kind of the actual meaningful things that autistic people get involved with, I think it really comes from this sense of justice. And I think sometimes it's thought of, oh, this is a special interest, which sounds like a selfish thing, but often it isn't. It's interesting. I think probably you're right. I think probably all neurodiversity will lead to passionately pursuing things. That's probably true.
But it's like, I was just going to say, but it's like what Ben said, like it can be the double-edged sword. Because like you said, if you use your energy all in one thing, like when I was a teacher, I used my energy all in teaching and it took over my life. You can ask Ben, it took over my life. So there's that double, you know, there's the up and downs of, you know, kind of all, like, and the same with like the people with autism and the, you know, that justice thing, it can be, you know, it can be a good thing, but then it can also have, you know, the other side to it.
It can cause really significant frustrations, can't it? Yeah, that's true. Would you agree with that, Ben? Is that something that you've experienced?
Yeah, like what Tess said, like when we first started going out, obviously we weren't living together. We were what, 22, 23 at the time. So we were both still living at parents' house. So we would only see each other, you know, two or three times a week, something like that, when we first started going out. But it was quite difficult because, you know, she was coming back from work, but then she wanted to be such an out, you know, being a good teacher wasn't good enough.
Mm.
You know, she had to be an outstanding teacher all of the time. And that kind of, you know, it work didn't stay at work. Work was at home as well.
Yeah.
Which was quite difficult in the beginning. But I could kind of see past that. Like a lot of frustration got taken out on me, because there was nowhere else for it to go, I guess. But you know, I knew that something else was going on. I don't want to say that, but you know, I could tell that it was as a result of her passion for this. Yeah. For this job, that's, you know, it wasn't how she was. It was just how she was being, if that makes sense.
Do you think therefore that it was, I mean, Natasha come in as well. And it's interesting in the sort of, did it feel like perfectionism or was it more?
I think that was an element of it. Yeah. Yeah. There was such it was more than like, I just want to be a good teacher. It was like she needed to be a good, you know, we're not even a good teacher. So the teacher gradings are what, like, requires improvement, good and outstanding.
Yeah.
So it was the need to be an outstanding teacher all of the time.
Yes. And whereas actually, all of the time thing as well.
Yeah. Whereas actually an outstanding teacher is good all of the time and outstanding, you know, occasionally.
Yeah, it's a very good point.
Yeah,
it's a very, very good point. And so do you, and I just wonder about that because I think partly that may be a direct ADHD thing, but maybe that comes from previous experiences and frustrations. I don't know what you think about that. I think we brushed on that last time we spoke, didn't we, Natasha? And sort of the kind of previous perfectionism. But where do you think that came from?
I think it's kind of two things. It's kind of that perfectionism of never living up to quite expectations and never quite, I always just kind of missed what people wanted. So when I became a teacher, I was really good at it. And I'm quite happy to say that I was a really good teacher. And I think I realized that and I was passionate about it, but then it was to an extreme.
Mm.
And then it became everything. Like I had to be the perfect, and the only happy place I was in my classroom. No offense, Ben, but like it was honestly. But then it was that hyper focus of that intense thing of putting everything into one basket. So it was just kind of like again, like I said earlier about the intensity. But then it was hard for me to switch my focus. Was to transition. Which yeah. I really struggle with, and I know a lot of people with ADHD struggle with. So because my hyper focus was like sometimes I wouldn't eat or, you know, sleep properly because I was so hyper fixated on it and hyper focused that the transition and everything else was really difficult and the effort was so hard that it tripled everything else part of my life. And I see that a lot in the ADHD community where they put so much effort and into one part because balance is really difficult.
Yeah. That's really interesting, isn't it? Finding a balanced view is probably particularly hard for neurodiverse people. And how did you come out of that? And again, we've touched on it before, but I remember you being very good on the subject. So let's do it again.
I left the UK. No,
probably not a facetious comment, but it's going out of your own culture.
I think that's a lot of teachers, like obviously we've experienced different countries now and met teachers from the UK and other places. A lot of teachers from the UK are teaching abroad because they didn't want to teach in the UK. It kind of, they got not driven out, but the conditions were such that you know, it you because like when you become a teacher, you know, you don't do it for the money, really.
No
long holidays. But what? No, you do it because
you work during the holidays. I keep constantly being told how much you work during the holidays.
But you do it because you want to help and you want to make a difference and you're passionate about a particular subject or something like that. But what you find and what we found, both of us, was that it was just you just got buried under lesson planning and marking and policy and all of that. And actually sometimes it felt like kind of teaching became secondary to all of that.
So we left. I actually remember the day we decided to leave, I was really bad and my emotions kept coming out on Ben, my frustrations, my emotional regulation was on fire. And to take it out on Ben, and we had a serious talk where it was like, Tass, like you've got like this, there's something going on here. Like this is not okay. And we were actually on the phone and it was I even remember the day it was dark and it was raining and I was crying. And Ben said, look, Tass, this is not okay. This is not like not normal, but it's not typical. This is not how people, most teachers are. So we went, okay, should we leave? Okay, great. So we made a plan that night and then I like quit like a month after and we left about 3 months later.
And you went to, where did you go first? Because you didn't go to Malaysia first, or did you?
No. So we didn't, like, if we'd actually thought about it, we'd have probably done it a little bit differently. So we left... Because we didn't consider that international schools were even a thing to go and do. So we both got qualified to teach English as a foreign language, which neither has abused. So we thought, oh well, we'll just kind of pick up 6 month jobs here and there if we need to. So we left. We left the UK, we did a bit of traveling, we ended up in Australia, stayed there for a year, but I didn't teach. Tasha kind of did tutoring. And then we left there, ended up in China, taught in China for 2 years, and then came to Malaysia just over 2 years ago.
But I suppose, obviously escaping the UK system and the peculiar constraints of that was probably one thing, and maybe experiencing outside of that, just, kind of being an outsider in a...
I think we've gone sideways a little bit. But yeah, that, like you said, like what helped and sort of leaving the UK and being in a system... So that this is sort of the main part of the point is that being outside of the UK and being in systems where actually you did have less to do in terms of paperwork, and actually the classroom became a bigger part of the job, and you could leave at 4 o'clock and that was it. There was nothing that was needed to be done in after hours because there was enough time in the day to get all of that extra stuff done. Helped a lot because there was none of that being brought home anymore.
It was a job rather than a kind of all-encompassing.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Life, I suppose. And okay. And so what, I mean, I suppose what about the future? So you're going to come back to the UK. What are your kind of, this may be a dangerous
hopefully you don't get listeners from that are in high up positions in schools, because I've just talked about not enjoying teaching in the UK. But no, I do.
One of our first guests is a head teacher, and he's probably cheering everything that you were just saying. So I wouldn't worry too much.
No, but I mean, I do plan on continuing to teach. Initially, because I don't want to have to start again, if you know what I mean. I don't want to have to go back to an entry level job. I can come back and I can teach, and I can do that. I would probably go on supply teaching initially whilst we settle, and then hopefully find, I mean, the dream is to find a job where it's probably even a private school, to be honest, because I guess that that would be more similar to what I've been experiencing over the last few years.
Yes, I imagine you're right. They always remind me of the private school system, the international schools.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's what it is, really. But yeah, get into that, you know, depending on how it goes, you know, I may find, you know, the stars may align and, you know, may find a school that, you know, that's supportive and, you know, the teaching hours aren't huge and there's enough time in the day to, you know, and I may carry on with it, but I can't see myself teaching for the next 40
years. Where is
this
mythical school in the UK?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. You know, but I mean, I can't see myself doing it until retirement, but then if it was such that I needed to, I don't think I would be, you know, particularly disappointed with that as a as a career. Sure. I'm not particularly bothered about becoming a head of department or a senior leader or anything like that. I'd rather just be a lowly cog in the machine, as it were. But you know, I'd be happy with that. You know, if there was a school, you know, and there was a good department, you know, a good set of.
Well, it sounds like somebody needs to pick you up, because anyone who wants to just work and not you know, rise up the slippery pole is an asset.
Yeah,
she just wants to get on and do the work forever.
Yeah,
amazing, great.
Yeah,
and
I mean, I enjoy being in the classroom. You know, I enjoy interacting with the students, and you know, you build relationships with these kids, and you see them grow up, and you know, you help them do well, and then they pass and achieve, and they go off on their merry way, and then you've done a good job.
Enormously satisfying, isn't it?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And Natasha, you said the coaching business is taking off. Yeah. Is that kind of the long-term plan as well? Is that?
Yeah, like, so we like, because traveling is a big thing for us, and you can probably tell the novelty of travel as well. Like, you know, I've literally booked a holiday every month until he comes back, because I can't, you know, because it's that thing. This is our life. We've got three little fur babies as well. So, sorry, he hates when I say that, but little fur babies as well. So he's got one there and I've got two here. So he'll come back, and then, yeah, coaching and exploring through there and seeing where it goes. But, yeah, we'll be travelling the most the rest of our lives. I think it's exciting for both of us, isn't it? And it keeps my brain going, and it, you know, it just playing to our strengths and just going from there. So yeah.
Excellent.
Another reason to stay a teacher as well, isn't it? And get the,
yeah. Get the long holiday.
Yeah.
You definitely don't get. Okay, well, that all sounds pretty amazing. All the best for the future, guys. Now, that's the end of this section of the podcast. And what we're going to do next is Natasha and I are going to talk about her mum and her mum's response to a couple of questions that we posed to her over Christmas. It's been a while. Lots of stuff under the bridge since then, isn't it? But we're going to go through, we're going to have listen to those questions and talk about those. So we're going to let Ben go back to whatever Malaysian day brings you. Well, actually, probably, what time is it there now? It's supposed to be bedtime.
It's 10 to 9. It's plus 8 hours at the moment from UK. Okay.
So you better get your beauty sleep.
Yeah. I need to wash off first.
And so Ben, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me.
And goodbye. Thank you.
Yeah, cheers.
Okay, so Natasha joins me again without Ben. Got rid of Ben. Don't need Ben. No, we do. We love Ben. But that was a really great chat with Ben, and kind of reflecting on his perspective from a very hot-looking Asian location. And now we're going to listen to your mum, who's not in a hot Asian location. Where is your mum?
She's in the cold Yorkshire. Right. Cold up north.
So she's a good Yorkshire mum, which does come through, actually, I have to say. But let's listen to an edited version of your mum's answer to what she would say to her younger self, and what she maybe would have done differently if she knew then what she knows now.
When she was really little, it just seemed like a normal parent, you know. She was just growing up with the two sisters. She was so full of life and always talking. As soon as she got up first thing in the morning at 6 o'clock, she never shut up until she went to bed at night. But she was always on the go. She was always energetic. And it wasn't until she was about 4 or 5, she started to, if we changed everything, if we promised her this was going to happen on a certain day and we changed it, then the mood swings would come into focus. She was like a Jekyll and Hyde. She'd be up one minute and then quickly down the next. And with me working as well in a really hard, demanding job, working with special needs children, it was really hard when I come home from work. You never knew how she was going to be, because she was so unpredictable throughout the years of her life and I tried to handle it as best as I could, tried to keep calm. But sometimes when I'd been at work all day and I'd come home and something could set her off, and she'd be marching up the stairs, shouting and screaming. And then I'd have to go and try and calm her down, try and suss out what had happened. It'd probably be one of her sisters trying to wind her up, which would happen quite a lot, because the eldest sister always liked to wind her up, because then she'd get a reaction from her. But that's not what I really needed when I come home from work. And that, and sometimes I didn't handle it very well. I'd end up shouting, and we'd both have a screaming match, and then I'd have to just leave her to calm down. Really, you know, it was hard. But the eldest sister always said, "Why don't you take her to the doctor's, Mum? There's something wrong with her." But I knew that she was just different to the other two. It was just, she was just different.
And the second question that I asked Natasha's mum via Natasha was if there's anything she would have done differently.
Now what I do know now about her, I do wish that I'd realised years ago as she was growing up, because we would, I don't know whether we would have got any more help than she has done at university and things, but you know, I might have had more help in how to having to cope with her inner moods and things like this. I just did what I thought was best. But I do wish that I did realise at that time that she needed help and she wasn't coping. But because there was no need at school, there was no complaints or anything throughout her school and everything, and she was doing her homework, she was doing a reading, and the only thing was her writing. But then every child has problems with that sometimes and that. But I'd have taken to the doctors, I'd have got help.
Okay. So how did it feel asking your mum those questions? I mean, is it something you talked about before?
No, so like my mum, I obviously, like, you know, I gave her the questions like a week before, and then we procrastinated over doing it. Sure. And then all that happened, we procrastinated and we kept putting it off.
Well, and you're the only person of the people I mentioned who I asked to do it who actually did it. So I wouldn't beat yourself up too much.
We were quite late, but my mum just said, mum just one morning was just like, right, let's just do it, because we keep putting it off, let's just do it. So I was like, okay. And I just asked her and then she just answered. And I obviously sat there with her, but yeah, she did it all herself, and it's really big for her because she's not really like the public speaker. So I was really big for her, and I was really proud that she did it. So it was a proud moment for me for her to kind of take that step out of her comfort zone.
Yeah, and what really, two things really struck me, really. One was that you, as a child, outwardly were really coping, were really, do you see what I mean? You were doing well by most outward measures. And that made me think of all the kids, all the adults who get to a certain point in their life and then their ADHD becomes problematic, at which point sometimes things really fall apart. So I suppose that I thought that was really interesting. But then at the same time as functioning well, you were very different. And it was that, and I think she's really kind of got kind of, you know, a real balance between, well, we want to help, but we don't want to just point out difference and make that, you know, we would call it pathologize now, but you know, but you know, just sort of make a fuss, I suppose you'd say in Yorkshire, wouldn't you? You don't want to make a fuss. My mum's from Yorkshire, so I know Yorkshire.
My mum's actually not from Yorkshire, she's from Leicester. But basically I think that when I grew up, like, my mum just embraced me. So like when she was speaking, like, I cried after, because it was quite emotional, like, to hear mum saying this. And I think my mum just embraced the difference, right? And that's where she said, like, I was hard to deal with at home, the emotions and stuff, but no one ever picked it up at school. Because obviously internally I was struggling, but externally to appear to everyone else, I just seemed like I was just okay.
Yeah.
And it's in a sense
you'd call it masking, wouldn't you, in a way? Yeah. We might use that term now. Sorry, I interrupted you.
You're all good.
Sorry.
You're all good.
Two ADHD people in the room. saying about how you were coping externally, but internally things weren't so easy. Because I won't interrupt you this time.
So, like, it's that thing of, like, so when, for instance, when I was diagnosed, obviously they ask for your parent and the, like, and people now in your life, don't they, to compare it. So my mum, just with my mum's kind of, you know, the questionnaire, it appeared that I was hyperactive. Just hyperactive. And then when they did my partner now and my sister, it showed that I was combined.
Yeah.
Because it was different parts of myself, and then different people's ability to see different parts of who I was. And who I was, though the masking was really, you know, obviously the masking of school then affected, because my mum used to say I was like Jacqueline Hyde. One minute I was one way, one minute I was the other way. Because that mask would come off when I was at home, because I'd be comfortable. So the external hyperactive kid would come out.
And that's really challenging for families, isn't it? Sometimes when they're convinced the child's got ADHD at home, they're presenting in all of these ways, but the school genuinely don't see it. And it's not that the school are in denial necessarily. I mean, it used to happen that schools would get in denial, but I haven't seen that for quite some time. I think everyone accepts that it's a thing now. Well, except a few people on Twitter, but we'll not worry about them. but it was really interesting, because I think bright kids with ADHD can not be misdiagnosed, but you won't pick up the inattention until they're really stretched academically, until they get to the point where they're kind of reaching their potential. And because most of the time as a kid with ADHD in class, I remember tuning out like every minute, but I still could work out the gist of what's going on, because, you know, really the cognitive pace of the lesson was so slow that you could just dip in and out more or less at will, and you could still work it out what's going on.
And it's that thing of, like, if you know, and I mean, academically I was okay. I wasn't like really high, but because I'll say the thing of, but, you know, girls, you know, internalizing it a lot more, and that school, because there was so much pressure to fit in, you kind of did everything that you could to get by. And that thing of, you like, in like your homework, right, would take, like my mum said, I'd have to break it down. Like, she would take so many more hours, but my mum was a teacher. So she would break it down for me. She would do all the things necessary, like my reading and stuff. She would be there, like, accountability, right? The reading here. If I didn't have that, I probably would have been an absolute mess at school. So I had the support systems that I needed.
Exactly. And very lucky. I mean, that's obviously really lucky. And she probably did a lot of it instinctively without even realizing she was doing it. And without even realizing she was compensating for an additional need. She was just doing it because it was how she's trained.
Yeah, and she's an SEN teacher.
Yeah.
She was an actual, like, she worked in special needs for like 16, well, for like 30 years. So she knows how to break it down, right?
God, what a career. How tough is that? Amazing. And I suppose just thinking about the process, I mean, having obviously talked to me in one of, in the previous episode, the number of which I can't remember, but it's one of the previous episodes, and then to talk with Ben and your mum, that kind of external perspective on yourself. I mean, I'm sure you've talked to them before about this stuff, but do you feel that external perspective is valuable for you in your kind of ADHD, understanding your ADHD and moving forward with it?
Yeah, because obviously I only understand it from my perspective, right? Because ADHD affects not just the individual, it affects everybody around. Obviously it affects the individual more, but it affects everybody because it's something that is, you know, it is different and we have to do different things, different strategies. And in order to do that, the support systems around. And it is interesting when you ask people, right, what their perception of, like, when you get angry is, and they're like, well, nothing ever happened and you just suddenly blew up. But for me, it was like, well, this happened, this, you know,
yeah,
and it's just that really different perspectives. And it also, for me, it helped me when it came to like my triggers and what to do, because it helped having those people and also to manage it. Because, like, especially myself and Ben, we have a lot of systems. We went to coaching ourselves and we have a lot of systems that work for us. And it wouldn't have happened if I'd not had his perspective.
Yeah, no, that's really valuable, actually. And I suppose, speaking of coaching, I think probably, you know, you have your own coaching business, Indigo Hub. And I suppose that kind of external perspective, in a way, you're an external perspective for other people, aren't you? In a way,
yeah.
a helpful one. I suppose that's the whole magic of it, in a way, is turning people's, reflecting things back to people, I suppose.
Yeah, and make it, yeah, and inviting them to look at it from a different perspective, right?
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. So that's a way of saying you are Indigo Hub ADHD on all the social medias, I believe.
Yeah, I am. Yeah,
I think I got that right. And people can look you up, and they've probably got, you know, if they watch both, if they've had. They listen to both episodes back to back. They've got like the Natasha Momnibus.
It's literally like I've put all my, this is like the first time I've ever like brought family into it, but I've put everything on the cards. And it's just because I'm such a big believer that it about if you don't have the right support systems,
yeah,
then it can fall apart what you're doing. And it's like when you, like, you know, as a teacher, I worked with children, you do everything you could, but then they go home and they wouldn't have that. And
exactly,
it's that. You've got to have that kind of continuity between everyone in your lives. And that's why bringing my mum and bringing Ben in here was just a kind of way of, you know, showing people that when you do have that support system, it can make such a difference.
Yeah. And actually, it was my wife, Sally's idea to do this series, which is now finishing.
Yeah.
Of these episodes, so it all ties together very nicely. Shout out to Sally, who's just been on the news. How exciting!
Woohoo!
Thank you very much, Tasha. I'm no doubt we'll have you on again, in some capacity or another on the podcast or other video, whatever we do.
Always,
next.
Always.
Goodbye. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
And that was the full 360 on Natasha as an example of an ADHD person. Fantastic episode. Listening to it back, there's an awful lot to dig into, isn't there? But just a huge amount of positivity as well. Natasha's a very positive person. As I said, she's Indigo Hub ADHD on all the social medias. We are Extra Brains Pod on similarly these kind of silly websites that we all spend our times on. And Extraordinary Brains Pod .com is the website. We will be back. We don't exactly know when. If you want to come and talk to us about your story, please do. We're more than happy to speak to anyone who wants to come on. But other than that, goodbye.